Okay, well, welcome everyone to the meeting tonight, particularly those of you whose first time at one of our meetings. The meeting is entitled Israel a Terror State, and I think if you think about what's happened over the last 5 weeks, for millions of people around the world, the reality of what Israel represents in relationship to the Palestinians, the role of Israel in relation to the Palestinians, and the violent and racist nature of the Israeli state has really become hugely exposed, isn't it? In the events around Gaza. Now, I'm not going to talk in detail about Gaza tonight. I mean, if you want to raise it in the discussion, do. We had a meeting a couple of weeks ago which dealt with some of the specifics around Gaza. If you want to raise a particular question about Gaza, then do. But just to say, if you think about what's happened over the past 5 weeks in Gaza, well, we know this stuff, which is worth reminding ourselves. We're talking about getting on for 2,000 people killed. The vast majority of those people, Palestinian civilians living in Gaza, one of the most densely populated urban areas in the world, an area the size roughly of Chesterfield and Mansfield put together, with a population of 1.8 million people crowded into that area, being bombarded in a most ruthless way, more than 400 children killed, 10,000 wounded. I read today in the paper stories of British doctors who are going out to Gaza at the moment to do the most complex and difficult trauma surgery on essentially people who've been living in a war zone. So there's sort of really complex and difficult wounds that people get from that sort of attack. Huge destruction of property in Gaza. I mean, the scale of the events have been absolutely huge and momentous, and have really caused a very significant response around the world in support of Palestinians in respect to that. Now, I say I'm not going to deal with the specifics of that. What I want to deal with is some of the key arguments, it seems to me, that underlie the whole debate about Israel-Palestine, and particularly to deal with some of the arguments that defenders of the State of Israel sometimes will attempt to throw up in terms of attempting to put up some sort of defence of the state of Israel. So I think it's important for us as people who want to campaign on behalf of the Palestinians, that we're very clear about the arguments, understand the arguments and the history, and are able to put a very clear and convincing argument to people, to a very wide audience of people out in society who've had their eyes opened by what they've seen on the television screens, but are a bit confused and muddled about some of the arguments about Israel and what it represents, etc. So what I want to do this evening is do a few things. I want to really discuss the nature of this movement we call Zionism, which is essentially the political movement that was established in favour of a specifically Jewish homeland in Palestine. I'll say a bit about Zionism's history as a movement and what it represents and why it's come to the stage it has come. I want to say a little bit about the formation of the State of Israel. Israel was formed as a state in the years 1947-48, technically 1948, in essentially a war against the Palestinians, a genocidal war against the Palestinians in 47-48. I want to talk a bit about that experience. It's an experience the Palestinians have a word for, they call the Nakba. Which means disaster, the catastrophe for the Palestinian people. So a bit about that. And I want to deal in particular with the accusation by supporters of the State of Israel that for people like us to oppose what Israel is doing and to support the Palestinians in some ways means the arguments we're putting forward are somehow anti-Semitic, that somehow support for the Palestinians, opposition to the State of Israel, makes you an anti-Semite, which I think is a really heinous argument, but we need to take on it. As part of that, I think there's an overriding question that lots of people, particularly people who sort of think a bit about the world and politics and history, ask themselves about the whole situation with Israel-Palestine, which is this question: how is it that a state, the State of Israel, that was formed, founded by people who were themselves, if you want, the survivors and the victims of one of the greatest crimes of humanity, the Holocaust, of the Nazi Holocaust. How is it a state that's formed by the survivors and the victims of that huge crime against humanity find themselves, decades onwards, inflicting huge racist organised violence against another group of people? That's an important question to be able to deal with. So those are really the issues I want to deal with. So I want to start with the question of Zionism and this movement called Zionism. And I think it's important that we get our terminology correct, because all sorts of different arguments are thrown up. Zionism is a very specific political term. It refers to a political movement that developed primarily in the late 19th century in Europe amongst mainly Jews, well, not exclusively Jews, living in Europe, which argued that what Jews needed to deal with the racist oppression that Jews faced, particularly in the late 19th century, as we saw in continental Europe and around Europe, the growth, if you want, of racist ideas in particular, anti-Semitic ideas becoming far more established and virulent, and if you want, a sort of far more aggressive and racist form of nationalism developing across Europe. In response to that anti-Semitism, and by the way, that anti-Semitism is absolutely real. You know, places like Russia, for example, Jews, it's a huge discrimination. Millions of people were driven into exile, etc., etc. Zionism basic proposition was that European society was endemically anti-Semitic and that Jews needed a separate homeland, that really the only solution to the racism and oppression that Jews faced in Europe was a homeland, a country of their own, a state of their own, where they, as the Zionists argued, could A, be safe, and could, if you want, develop their Jewish culture, identity, practice their religion, etc., etc., and that's important. Now, that's what Zionism is. It's different from being Jewish, by the way. Jewishness is simply a cultural, historic, familial, to some extent ethnic, to some extent religious identity that people have. Millions and millions of people across the world are Jewish and self-identify as Jewish, but aren't Zionists. You know, don't support the idea of a specific state. And it's different from Judaism as well, by the way, which is a religion. I mean, many Jews are not religious. They don't, you know, particularly practice Judaism in any more way than I practice Christianity by having a turkey, you know, at Christmas. They don't necessarily practice Judaism. So we need to be clear about the terminology. Zionism is a very particular political movement. Now, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, when Zionism was developing as a political movement, it was, and this is an important point to us, it was a minority strand of opinion in Jewish European society. The vast bulk, if you want, of political, artistic, cultural life amongst Jews who were oppressed by anti-Semitism was to fight against their oppression within the context of the communities and societies in which they lived. In that sense, Jews very much played a really, really important role in what we might call the progressive movements in those societies, in movements for social change, in movements for democracy and liberation in those societies, the idea of democratic rights, political rights, and also in the socialist movement, has to be said. The socialist movement was a very important home for millions and millions of European Jews who saw, you know, they were oppressed in the society in which they lived, but saw a solution, not as going off and founding their own separate states, but fighting for a more fair and equal and just society in the societies in which they live. Zionism was a minority opinion. The vast majority of Jews followed a range of different political, you know, from liberalism, a small minority being what you might call conservative, and large numbers of Jews identifying with the left, basically, with socialist ideas. And that meant there was a problem for the Zionist movement. They were a small movement. They didn't have mass majority support inside Europe. And they faced another phenomenal and important problem as well. Because I said the basic proposition of Zionism was that Jews needed a separate homeland for themselves. But they faced a problem, apart from being a relatively small movement in terms of doing it. Think about it. You are, you know, in the world in the 1890s. How and where do you go about establishing a new state to be your exclusively Jewish state, which is the idea that Zionism exposed. Now, I want to just read a quote from a very useful article written by a fellow socialist, a guy called John Molyneux, which if you should read, it's on his blog, on the johnmolyneux.blog, read it on the internet. It's a very, very good article he's written that's called The Grim Logic of Zionism. I'm going to read a fairly lengthy quote from that that deals with the problem the Zionist movement faced. He said, unfortunately, there were, from the outset, two problems with the Zionist project. Where was the state to be located, and how was it actually to set up? Where do we locate it? How do we set up a state? He says, by the time Zionism established itself in the 1890s, there was nowhere in the world to which a significant number of Jews could be attracted that which was vacant. And actually, there were all sorts of ideas floated around where a possible Zionist state might be set up. But frankly, you're not going to appeal to large numbers of people from London, Berlin, Vienna, Kiev, Warsaw, New York to go to Greenland There's nowhere around in the world, if you want. By the 1890s, Lenin, the great Russian revolutionary, had talked about the world being carved up by imperialism. Every corner of the globe had by that stage been carved up by the major European powers to their own little bits of empire. And therefore, where do you set up this Zionist state? And also, how does that work? The combination of this problem meant that there was, in practice, only one way that a specifically Jewish state could be established. That was as a settler state, a colonising state in a territory already inhabited by a group of people who were, for whatever reason, strategically weaker than they were. And in order to do that, because the Zionist movement was relatively weak, it needed a sponsor. It needed some stronger group in world society with whom it could do a deal, who would provide the muscle and the background to do that. And that meant, effectively, the Zionist movement had to do a deal with one of the major imperialist powers in order to deal with that. And the major imperialist power at the time, of course, was Britain. Yeah, Britannia rules the world, the British Empire, the sun never sets, etc., etc. The British Empire was at its zenith. Do a deal with the British Empire to try and, you know, find some sort of... And for many decades in the late 1890s, early 20th century, the Zionist movement, very small, quite marginal movement, lobbied the British ruling class in particular to for support for the idea of setting up a Zionist. Didn't get very far, by the way. By the way, the British ruling class, tell you a little secret, were pretty anti-Semitic. You know, they weren't particularly well established towards Jews generally. Very, very strong strands of anti-Semitism inside the British ruling class. So they weren't particularly well disposed towards the Zionists. What changes, and really what changes are particular circumstances towards the end of the First World War in the Middle East, in effectively the area that is now Palestine. By the end of the Second World War, towards the end of the Second World War, 1917 is the key year really here, there are some important conjunctures coming together which cause, if you want, a situation where the interests of the British Empire and the interests of the Zionist movement coincide, come together, really. Those situations are this. Firstly, it was towards the end of the First World War. The major imperial power that controlled much of what we today call the Middle East was the Ottoman Empire, the former Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, was in serious decline, was being defeated, was falling apart effectively. The Ottoman Empire was in collapse. Very importantly, oil had been discovered in parts of what is now Iraq in terms of the Middle East, which was seen as a key strategic resource for the British Empire. And also, at the same time, in the Middle East, alongside the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, we've all seen Lawrence of Arabia, the film, there'd been the rise of Arab nationalism. Arab people themselves were rising up, beginning to demand their own self-government, their own self-rule, etc. Faced with that, the British ruling class saw a coincidence of opportunity and interest with the Zionist movement. And in 1917, Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary at the time, uttered his famous Balfour Declaration, which he said it was the intention of the British state to facilitate the establishment of a specifically Zionist state in historic Palestine. Hadn't been formed yet. It took another 20 years for the Zionist state to actually be formed as a fully fledged state, but that is essentially is a declaration, it's the interests of the British Empire. And the great quote is this one here I'm about to read you here, which tells you what the British saw from that, what they got out. And at the time in 1917, the governor of Jerusalem, the British governor of Jerusalem, Jerusalem was of course part of the British Empire at the time, Sir Ronald Saw said this. He said, "A Jewish homeland in Palestine, i.e. Israel, will form for England a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of potentially hostile Arabism." That's a reference to Ulster in Northern Ireland, the Protestant state in Ulster, which had been separated off with the idea of using it as a tool to police the development of Irish nationalism. We'll use this little settler state as a tool to police and control this dangerous but lucrative area of the Middle East, where we want to make sure we've got our controlling hands over. And that really sees the emergence of the Zionist movement as a really significant and movement. Now, in the period after the First World War, Zionist settlers, by the way, had been emigrating to Palestine and setting up Zionist communities, generally peacefully, by the way, living side by side with Arab neighbours since the late 19th century, been from a very, very small scale. That begins to accelerate in the 20s and 30s. In 1919, there's something like 50 or 60,000 Jewish settlers in historic Palestine. By the mid-1930s, that's 450,000. That's grown significantly. And clearly, and this is important for us, the rise of Nazism in Europe in the 1930s increases the popularity of Zionism. Absolutely, that's very understandable, isn't it? And the rise of fascism, the rise of Nazism, a real existential threat to the Jews in Europe, makes it far more attractive. The idea that we need a separate homeland becomes a far more attractive idea. Zionism, you know, takes on traction within the Jewish community because of the existential threat faced by the rise of Nazism and by the Holocaust. But worth just saying, let's be absolutely clear about it, when it came to Jewish refugees and people, you know, and the threat of Nazism and Jews fleeing from Nazi persecution in the 1930s, let's be clear about the Western powers, Britain, America, etc., etc. Did they open their doors and say, we'll take lots of Jewish refugees in? Well, no. We all read about the kinder transport in Britain, Jewish children being brought over. Very, very important. Tiny numbers. Tiny, tiny numbers. The American and the British government put very strict quotas on the number of Jewish refugees. If you want to get out of Nazi Germany, go to Palestine. You know, you can go there if you want. You can see how the two things begin to... Now, things really, in terms of the development of the State of Israel, in the post-war period, this is when the thing really developed. In November 1947, the United Nations votes for the partition of geographical Palestine into two states, a Jewish state and a Palestinian state in 1947. And that vote in November 1947 really gives a green light to the most aggressive and violent and nationalistic elements within the Zionist movement in what's now to become Israel. It's not yet the State of Israel, what's become the State of Israel. And the most aggressive and nationalistic elements of them. They had a military organisation by that time called the Haganah, which subsequently morphs into what we know as the IDF, the Israeli Army. And you begin then from late 1947, from the vote in the UN 1947, to begin the process of the Nakba, which is effectively ethnic cleansing of Palestinians out of large, large areas of historic Palestine. Most of the territory that is now seen as sort of historic Israel in the midst of the original 1947 borders are ethnically cleansed from Palestinians, with the use of huge and deliberate violence by the Israeli state. David Ben-Gurion, a great hero of Zionism, of the Israeli state, says this about the Palestinians. They can either be mass arrested or expelled. It's better to expel them. Very clear. You know, people are being driven out. There's a modern term for this. We call it ethnic cleansing, don't we? This is the modern terminology. We call it ethnic cleansing. This is what was being carried out by Haganah at the time. They had a military plan called Plan Dalet, which was the key strategic plan of the Haganah, which is the Zionist armed force. They said this, talking about the operation, how to deal with the Palestinian population. These operations can be carried out either by destroying villages, by setting fire to them, by blowing up, and by planting mines in their rock. This is the orders given out to Haganah in Plan Dalet. And especially those population centres which are difficult to control permanently, or by mounting combing and control operations according to the following guidelines. Encirclement of villages, conducting search inside them. In the case of resistance, the armed force must be wiped out and the population expelled outside the borders of the state. And that was the process, essentially, whereby, and I mean, I haven't got time to go into a history of the Nakba, but if you talk to Palestinians, who, and the vast majority of Palestinians now, you know, have a very good sense of their own history, you know, they'll talk about the Nakba, and the names of the place will come up, you know, the names of the towns and villages. You know, Deir Sin, for example, famously site of a huge massacre. The town of Haifa, for example, which is now an almost entirely Jewish town, its Palestinian population almost, you know, almost non-existent now. Ethnically cleansed by fire, basically. They had a roll, they've got big oil drums full of oil, set them on fire and roll them into the specific Palestinian areas of the town in order to burn the population out. Tantara, for example, more than 400 people gunned down and their bodies buried in the sand in a single village in 1948. So this process taking place through 1947, in 1948, as this process takes power. And that leads to mass expulsions, and the numbers are huge in terms of population. 850,000 refugees, and think about the population, the overall population of Palestine then is far, far smaller than it is today. 850,000 refugees expelled from historic Palestine into the surrounding areas, into Lebanon, into Syria, into Jordan, what's now known as the West Bank, and also, by the way, of course, into Gaza. Gaza was then actually part of Israel, the Gaza Strip, that little strip of land that all the fighting was technically part of Israel. You know, who are the Gazans? Who are the Gazans now? The Gazans now are the descendants of the refugees who were forced out in 47, 48 into refugee camps in Gaza. That's why you hear people still talk about towns in Gaza are still described as refugee camps, aren't they? They are historic refugee camps. Now, this is a bloody and violent history. It's important we know it. This is the history of the... And that's why we call Israel a terror state. But let's be clear, this isn't unique. Yeah, Israel isn't unique in this respect. It's not that there's something particularly nasty about the settler and native population relationship in terms of Israel. Actually, it's very, very similar to what happens in a whole number of other historic examples, where we see the established, what we might call colonial settler states, where, you know, populations are moved into an area from essentially European powers to colonize it. Think about the experience of the Dutch Boers in South Africa when they arrived in South Africa in the early part of the 18th, late part of the 17th century, early part of the 18th. Actually, a bit like Jews from Europe, Dutch Protestants persecuting their own country, suffering religious persecution, actually. So actually, some of the most enlightened Holland at the time was probably one of the most civilized, enlightened, and liberal parts of the world. But you arrive at a foreign country to colonize it, and what do you have to do? You have to drive out the native population, don't you? If you're going to survive as a colonizing enterprise, that's how you do it. You have to take their land from them, don't you? You have to burn their villages. You have to, and if you're going to do that, you have to construct a racist ideology to justify why you're doing that. We see it with the Pilgrim Fathers in the United States, don't we? You know, how are the Native American Indians treated? By the way, there's for those people who were on the bus on Saturday, Matt Carr, one of the comrades from Matlock, has written a very, very interesting piece on his blog, mattcarr.blog, have a look at it, which makes a direct comparison to the Israeli military tactics being used against Gaza and actually the tactics used by the Federal Army in the Great Plains Wars in the 1860s to clear away the Native Americans. We all know that battle was big order, ethnic cleansing of villages, punitive measures against the whole population, etc., etc. So there's nothing unique to Israel. But this helps to explain why Israel resembles one of these settler states, a particularly nasty and virulent, and also helps to explain why racist ideas, anti-Arab and anti-Muslim racist ideas, are so fundamental to Israeli society, are so deeply ingrained. I mean, people may have seen some of the stuff in the last few weeks, the shots of Israeli civilians, the parties they have in Sidarot, which is the town in the south, and they've got a nice big hill in Sidarot where you can get a nice big view over Gaza. What's the big social event? Drinky poos in the evenings, out in your chair with your cocktails, watching the bombs fall on Gaza and cheering every time the bombs fall, and a few more Arabs and Palestinians are killed. Some of the racist stuff coming out of Israel at the moment, absolutely horrific. But that is a racist, set of racist ideas that are necessary, if you want, for a settler state. You have to justify the brutal things you're doing in order to set up your colonial enterprise by denying the humanity and existence of the people who exist there. First, to say Palestinians don't exist. Famous slogan in the early Zionist movement. We want a land without people for a people without land. We're the Jews, the people without land. We're not a land without people. There are no people here. There are no Palestinians. It's empty territory, just like the British described Australia. The legal terminology of Australia was terra nulla, wasn't it? Empty territory. There's no one lives there. Forget about the Aboriginals, we just wipe them out. That's how okay, the Palestinians exist, but then, you know, they're an inferior, all sorts of arguments about the Arabs that you see. They're backward, lazy, corrupt, dishonest, dangerous. When I was younger, back in the 60s and 70s, when actually pro-Israeli ideas were far more dominant inside society, all the stuff, I used to be very taken in by it. Also about, I lived in the Middle East for a period of time. Also about making the desert blue, how the Israeli, the kibbutzes have been set up. They were doing wonderful agricultural work, transforming previous deserts to beautiful agricultural communities. The backward Palestinians, when they'd run this place, couldn't do anything. They just sat around in tents and, didn't do much. We're now being far more productive and progress. All those ideas, really racist ideas, are absolutely endemic. But a further idea, which is really important, and leading on to the final thing we'll talk about, which is the idea that somehow Arabs and Muslims are fundamentally anti-Semitic. That if you want, this is the argument that goes, that Arab society, particularly Muslim Arab society, is fundamentally anti-Semitic. The argument is that Israel is surrounded by a hostile Muslim world, which is inherently anti-Semitic. And that anti-Islamic bit of it, anti-Muslim bit of it, and the idea that Muslims are uniquely anti-Semitic, I think is one of the biggest lies that's put forward by the Israelis that we need to really, 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 really deal with. And by the way, this Islamophobic element of the it's always been there in part, as part of the armoury the Israelis have used to defend, to argue for their state. But in the last 10 or 15 years, with the growth of Islamophobia generally, after the war on terror, you know, all the Blair, Bush, Blair bombing racks, all that stuff, this has become far more important. Look at any, if you can stand it, you don't throw up at the side, when you see the Israeli government spoken, Mark Regev, you know, the guy who mentioned that, apologies to the Israelis, what are they trot out, so 2 minutes, no, I'll have to do a bit more on that, but yeah. What I was going to try that time and time and time again, Mark Rego, is that, you know, we're on the front line against Islamic extremists, these, you know, mad Islamists who are trying to, you know, do, you know, what the Palestinians are doing is exactly the same as what terrorists are doing, you know, blowing up bombs in New York or whatever, etc. They're trying to equate the two. It's absolutely this argument is what we have to deal with. Anti-Semitism is real. I dealt with that earlier on. It's a real experience, but historically, anti-Semitism as a set of ideas is fundamentally a set of ideas that is located in European Christian society. That's where anti-Semitic ideas come from, and where historically they always have been rooted. To the extent that anti-Semitic ideas exist, and they do exist, by the way, in the Arab and Muslim world, the extent they exist, they are a European import. As much as, you know, drinking a can of Coke is a European import. They're a European import that's been imported from Europe, and they are also, to some extent, a wrong and very misguided response to the establishment of the State of Israel and what the State of Israel has done. It's not correct to have an anti-Semitic response if you're a Palestinian, you know, to blame Jews, but it is a response, and it's a European import. And it's worth saying a little bit, and I apologize, Mark, but I will end on this, a little bit about the history of the Muslim world in terms of Jews and religious tolerance. You see, at a time when, you know, us lot, the civilized Christian West, were busy, you know, slaying and destroying and discriminating against any religious minority we find, particularly Jews. Let's be clear, you know, in Britain we have history, a huge and bloody history of anti-Semitism in Jews, anti-Semitism in Britain, expulsion of the Jews, massacres of the Jews in York, etc., all the way across, you know, Christendom, the heart of civilization. Where in Europe could Jews go to find refuge, to find a society which was tolerant, which allowed their existence, allowed them to practice their religion? They went to the Muslim-controlled parts of Europe and the Mediterranean. When Spain, for example, the great Islamic Spanish period, where, you know, the huge, everyone's been to southern Spain, you know, to the wonders of the architectural wonders of the Alhambra, etc., high points of civilization. These were societies in which all religious minorities, these are Muslim societies in which religious minorities were essentially allowed to express them. But actually, we see an element of this in the horrific stuff going on in Iraq at the moment, don't we? How come, in the middle of this fantastic intolerant Islamic world, do we find these little pockets of, you know, Christians or the Yazidi communities that have been living for generations side by side with their Muslim neighbours, in effect, a coexisting society? Not to say there were never tensions between different religious groups. I'm not trying to paint an over rosy picture of that, but the idea of systematic discrimination of Jews is a European import. And this is the greatest slide that's got forward by the Israeli state one we need to know. Absolutely. So look, I'm going to shut up now and just say, look, the last 5 weeks have really pushed this whole argument onto centre stage. And I think for us, I mean, A, we've got to do the organising stuff around it. The demonstration last Saturday, you've seen some of the pictures, and people should talk about that in a bit. You know, we need to think about how we can, you know, mobilise in terms of support policy. But also, it throws up huge numbers of arguments, lots and lots of arguments. Some of the arguments I've raised tonight, but other arguments as well. Is there a two-state solution? You know, is that a viable solution for Palestinians? So those are the key arguments, really, we have to deal with. I think, lots of people in this room, myself included, have been campaigning on Palestine for decades, in one way or another. I think the scope for a really significant step change in terms of building support for the Palestinian cause has really been presented to us by the horrific events in Gaza. And really, it's our responsibility really to make sure that we build on that to give whatever important support to Palestinians we can. Thanks, cheers.
So I'll throw the meeting open so you can...